next session, number 29703, Reel 3.
Deal with a wounded man.
I have experience in one element shut down in the quay, who was badly wounded, and the people tucked him in heap of straw, see. And the doctor went to help him during the night, and he stayed three days in the hiding, and in the hay sack. And when he came enough well to be transported, they put it in a house. But the man have lost the memory of this previous living, you see. And it's only after I brought him and another one, it was Kenneth and Morrison, the German. I brought him to Amiens, and I put them in a safe place, and I visited them every week or for night. And the story, amusing story, is that when we talked, one was of the east, one was of the east, west. And they didn't understand them correctly, you see. They speak American, but not the same. And the one who have lost his memory was very fond of dirty story. Mm. So we met a competition about the good stories, you see. And one time the story the other airman told was so good, you see, that we lost so much that the other airman refound his memory. And I remember them on my wife, you see. It was terrific, you see. Well, it's a story, but anyway, when the airman was wanted, we have to deal with the physician and all the medical organization of the town or country, and usually they were very fair. See, at taking enormous risk. Yeah. Yeah, we had strong support from them.
But sometimes, surely, people were so badly injured they had to be turned over to the Germans or to the local hospital. There was no way that you could get them out. Is that the case? Have you any thoughts on that, madam?
Yes, I know that. Because it was just a case of death, life or death. And we always thought that it was best that he risked his, he risked being taken a prisoner and looked after. Because I must say, generally, they were taken care of by the Germans.
Yes. Well, when the evader had been successfully transported across France, presumably to Spain, I'm right in thinking that Spain was the country, the neutral country, into which most people were conducted. But actually crossing the border into Spain, or for that matter, into neutral Switzerland, must in itself have been quite a risk, because surely the Germans had those areas well and truly guarded. I don't know if any of the panel have any experience or comments on that situation. It would be interesting to know just how crossing the border was carried out.
Yes. I have a friend who went from Holland to Switzerland, happily. And in Switzerland, he was asked by the consul to work again for the Allies. So he went back, and in the south of France, he was what we called a passeur from the Pyrenees. Then he was caught. He was sent back to Holland, but as they thought he was a Frenchman, they sent him back to France, and they released him. So that's quite a story from one person. One thing I want to say, it was very dangerous when we had airmen who didn't ride on bicycle. We had an airman who came sound and safe in our hands, and we had to take him to a doctor because he fell down from his bicycle.
I can assure you that even in England, the American airman was known not to be safe on a bicycle. There is a story which is probably a good foundation that more American airmen were injured returning from what we call pubs late at night on bicycles than ever Adolf Hitler was able to deal with.
Certainly.
I should probably be shot for saying that.
No, but there are two sides to that story. And I'd like to say that for our Canadian friends present, one of their very good members there, who was the immediate past Prime Minister of Prince Edward Island, Angus Maclean, tells a story about being unable to ride a bicycle, and so it wasn't peculiar to Americans, but poor Angus had a hell of a time trying to get the bicycle and ride it from, I think it was Bayonne or Biarritz, to the Pyrenees. You know the story?
He couldn't
ride it.
It was a girl who put him on her bicycle and
pushed him.
Well, I think we better, this is a dangerous subject. I think you could have a symposium on the use of the bicycle. However, has anyone else any more comments on crossing the Pyrenees or getting into Switzerland?
Well, the men might be able to tell you something more than
have you any comments?
Lucien had some people that went that way.
Yes.
Was it particularly dangerous crossing the actual border?
Well, I don't know. I didn't do the crossing. I was busy elsewhere. And in March, we did three operations in the same month. We were supposed to do one operation a month. And we did three because the Paris were getting crowded with the airmen. We had to empty their lodgings. So we did three operations. And after that, Paris got filled up again because there was a talk there a while ago of how you got airmen into the network. Well, you didn't have to search for them, not in my case, because we got to be pretty well known in the underground parts, and they were coming in from the north end, Beauvais, and all around there, where the planes were coming, airmen were coming down pretty fast. So I started off shipping 30 of them right through Paris into the Pyrenees, and here I was. The rate was 10,000 francs per head to cross them into Spain. Well, they were contraband fellows there doing that, and in the peacetime they brought the tobacco and stuff from Spain and so on. And in wartime they had a new racket, of course, taking airmen across the Pyrenees. Well, my role was, I was too busy with other things, you know, being a chief of the network, you're busy. And I didn't have time to look into this, so I had a very good agent. He was an Alsatian. I'd like to tell you more about this fellow. He was pretty good. But anyway, I put him in charge of that, so I sent him down to the Pyrenees to make arrangements. And the thing was, it was costing 10,000 francs. Well, I said, fine. Tell the fellows down there, we'll bring down the airmen to them. I'll give them 10,000 francs before they leave and 10,000 francs when they're in Spain. It worked fine. That way I got 95 across. I paid double the price, so you can see where the millions of francs were going to. 20,000 francs a head to get them in the Pyrenees, 95, multiply all that you want, and you'll find this is a lot of million of francs.
He does seem very worried about that money. I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that he hasn't saved any to give to us up here. But, anyway, let's move on. In fact, this is Lucien again, because I know that he, in fact, ran one of the most successful escape routes, and this was by sea back to England. I wonder if you can tell us briefly how this was worked and why it was so successful.
Well, it was successful because everybody minded his own business and did his work well, which was rather important. And for me, not interfere into minor details. Let everybody get on with their job and pay whatever it was they were wanting for the trouble. It didn't really matter because, as they had been told, money doesn't matter. The idea was put across when before I left that an evacuation would take place from the coast of Brittany, which is closest to England, and I had plans. Made out for that before I left. So I went down to Brittany and got some local fellows to work on this. And everything went fine, except the chief headman down there, he got to talking. And I got news of that. He was in the cafes in Saint-Brieuc talking his head off. Too much to drink, of course, and he was the man responsible. And I got a report from in Paris of this. I got another report from England, no less, that somebody in the cafe in Saint-Brieuc was talking about airmen traveling through Saint-Brieuc. So I had to shut him up. So I thought the simplest thing was pay him off and tell him we weren't working there anymore. So I knew he was going to find out we were going to come. So I got the next man in line and told him, how are you willing to take that on? So sure, he says, I've been doing it that way. So he says, why not? So he took it on. François Lecornec, a local man, and he worked all the way through and did a lot of operations. And there were, of course, we had I had a very good radio man. He was a Canadian, of course, he had to be good. Raymond Labrosse, too bad he's not here. Some of you have met him, of course. He's a very nice chap, young fellow, and good at a radio operator, and he'd get the messages across fast and all that, in code, of course. And we'd ask for the operation by a message, of course, and in code, and they'd agree to it. And the evening of the operation, we'd be listening on the radio. They had a program in England, Les Français parlent au Français. The French are speaking to the French, you see. And messages coming over there, coming over the air. And, of course, we had three types. One was the operation is on. It was Bonjour tout le monde à la maison d'Alphonse. That was the operation's on. Yvonne pense souvent à l'heureuse occasion. That was number two. It says the operation is put off 24 hours. And the other one was, I can't remember now, because I never had a canceled damn thing, so I never used it, really. But it meant the operation is off until further notice. So we were warned at 6 o'clock that the operation was on or off. And at 9 o'clock, there was a repeat. Well, we started getting ready at 6 o'clock, of course. But we didn't give the final okay to anybody. They were ready to run there. So at 9 o'clock, there was a confirmation of the boats having left England, or the boat, rather, having left England and was on his way across. And there, we had the liaison fellows waiting there, not only fellows, girls, too. They were part of the network, and they passed off very easily, you know, much easier than men at night. And they'd run across to different groups, and it's on. And away they'd go with the airmen down to La Maison d'Alphonse, that was called that later on, which was a house about a mile away from the beach. And there we'd gather there, and I'd instruct the airmen what was going to happen. And some have memories of that, and what they were to do, and what not to do. And this was in the dead of night, very dark night, moonless night. So there are two guys in front taking them down to the beach. And before they got to the beach, there was a hell of a cliff there, 150 feet high or somewhere along that, and very steep. They had to go down there, down that cliff. When they got down there, of course, they were close to the rock there and they stay there. And on top of the cliff, there was a white light flashing every 2 minutes, letter B. And down below the cliff, there was a girl there, Marie-Thérèse Le Calvé, was there with a blue lamp. And it was dim. This was for a close approach to just where the beach was. Well, the boat would come in. The MTB would be about a mile out, and they'd get into rowboats, come to the beach. Not forget the satchel with the money, and provisions, weapons, pistols, and ammunition and stuff like that, and a few goodies like a bottle of whiskey and other things. And then there was a password. The minute we saw them at about 150 yards or something like that, we'd go out to them and generate cold water up to about your waist. Cold, I can shiver just by thinking of it. And we'd go out to meet them, and they'd be hanging on their boats there in the water themselves, the sailors, and with an officer. The officer would come forward, and whenever it got close enough, the password was put on. Dinant, he answered. Saint-Brieuc. Right, people. Right away, the incoming material was coming off, and the airmen was coming into the sea, getting aboard this small boats, being rolled out the MTB, and then we'd see them going away, and the next morning they'd be in England, quite proud, quite happy.
Well, that was a remarkable operation, and The mention of careless talk there leads me to ponder, I wonder how many Allied airmen did in fact prove a problem because they talked too much or were a little naughty, misbehaved themselves. How did the average Allied airman conduct himself? Did you have problems with people? I'll put that first of all to Madame here.
No, I've never had any trouble at all with them. Maybe one who said that potatoes were falling on his plate like V1s in London because he had too many of that and not enough of the other. But otherwise, no, I never had any trouble.
How about you, Gus? Did you have any problems?
Well, we had no problems, but that's what I said in the beginning. Never ask your name. Never tell your own name. Just pass people. So what they don't know, they can force you to tell. And you never know if you are strong enough when they torture you to keep your tongue and don't say names. So we had no troubles at all because I never gave my name. Once I gave a few Jews in my car. And they said, "You must order Kerke." I said nothing. I wouldn't make a reproach to them. But the man who sent them to me afterwards, I said, "That's the last time I take people from you in my car. I don't want that they know my name. I will take them everywhere you ask me, but don't say my name."
But you had no problem with the people you were helping being difficult?
No.
Mr. Atkinson, did you have any experience of Allied airmen who were bored or a problem and you had to sort of keep them in check?
I think no. The first problem we had is they had too large stomach.
I'm sure you're talking about the Americans, not the British.
And sometimes too large feet.
Well, that sounds more like the British.
Yes.
Have you anything to say on that, sir, briefly?
Yes, I have something to say. I'll save the American pride. It wasn't an American. Leo the Belgian. He was an ace. He shot down a few planes and he was good, so he said. And he was in Paris. And I heard about him. He's going around at night, in the evening, going down to the cafe, bringing two friends along, two American airmen, into the cafes and having a damn good drink and getting drunk, more or less, and so on. I heard about this and I went over there and told them off. I said, "You're going to stay inside. You've been told, and you're going to stay inside or you're going to be in trouble." Well, he didn't get into trouble because we sent him off to Brittany. And in Brittany, the first damn thing he did, he quit his conveyors and went into the cafe for a drink. Well, of course, he was a Belgian, so he spoke French, and that was fine. Only I heard about this, and I wasn't too pleased about it. Not very pleased about it. And he was wanting to go out again and play les boules. So I said, "Well, I don't know who this guy is, what he's a Belgian or is an ace or what, but I'm going to have him in England without too much trouble." So I got one of my very good men. I said, "Get yourself your pistol and we go into this place and we're going to fix this." He was in a lodging with two American airmen. I told my fella, "Keep your pistol pointed at the Americans and I'm going to tell them to stay out of this business because none of their affair." And, of course, we went in, two pistols pointing, told the Americans, "Get to the other end of the room and stay there before you get shot. It's none of your business. Stay out of it." And pushed the other fellow to the wall. I said, "Leo, you've made enough trouble as it is. You're not going to make any more troubles. Because if you do, I'm going to kill you. Belgian or not. I'm going to kill you. You made too much trouble as it is. I'm going to give you one chance. If you're going to be good and quiet, I'll take you over to England. But you're going to be handcuffed." So I had a pair of handcuffs. His hands up. Put a handcuffs onto his wrist. Tied him to the bedstead. "You're going to stay there. If you don't, that's the end of you. You won't get across." And he was taken over under handcuffs. I don't know what they did with him over there. But you know what they said? The Belgian airman, he's got a lot of debts. He borrowed money in Paris. You better pay off the people. You know what my answer was? "Well, if you take me from there, and boy, you're mistaken. You come over and pay your debts for him, not me. I'm not worrying about that." Lovely story.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, at this point, I'm going to bring the audience in to participate in the session. But I may stop you very abruptly because we have a special surprise. We're trying to arrange a telephone link with the participant who wasn't able to be here because of ill health, Colonel Langley, who was one of the bosses of MI9. And he's sitting by his telephone, and it's now about 9:30 in England, and if they can contact him, he's going to say a few words of the transatlantic link. So I apologize if I have to cut somebody short.
What was the response of the Spaniards when these people arrived? I thought they were friendly with the German administration at that time. Were they interned, or were they? How did they get them out of Spain? Also in Switzerland, how did they? Weren't they just interned?
Well, that's a very good question, and in fact, it was on my list here. Mm-hmm. But I wondered if somebody would like to comment on that. Would you like to have a go at it first,
yes,
Gus?
Yes, of course. I know they were put in working camps, no real concentration camps, in Spain and also in Switzerland. And from Spain, you should bring them over the frontier. There were passes again. Took them to Portugal. But from Switzerland, there was no possibility, except a few men who escaped from Switzerland to France. But that's not an escape, of course.
Yes. Now, isn't it a fact, and in fact, we should have defined the difference between escape and evasion at the start of this session, that evasion, which is evading capture, and escape, which is escaping from somebody who has captured you, are important in so much that I believe in international law at that time, every neutral country was bound to help an escaping military man, whereas an evader was a different kettle of fish and could be interned, so that everyone had to say, even if they were evaders, that they were actually escaping. Is that right, Lucien?
Well, I have no trouble with any of that, sorry. So escaping, of course, I was an escaper and an evadee myself. I escaped from after the Dieppe raid, and I evaded capture after that, but it's a very seldom that we met. I didn't meet any escapers myself in my network. Evaders, plenty of course, 307 of them, that's quite a lot. That's half a regiment, half a battalion anyway, and I was pleased with the record there. But evadees, I never met any, I'm sorry.
But I think that is right. Yes, sir, your name? Do you think you could go to the microphone, sir, because the folk at the back have difficulty in hearing. Thank you very much.
I evaded to Switzerland, and although I did not get any specific distinction on the treatment between evaders and escapers, the general feeling was that...
Can I halt you? Because we now have... please continue in a moment, sir. Don't go away. We now have Jimmy Langley on the phone, wherever that will come from. Well, where? We're waiting for a plug. Jimmy Langley.
Hi. How about now?
This is Ralph Patton. I hear the echo, so I assume that I'm coming through loud and clear. I have with me on the telephone Colonel Jimmy Langley, who was the head of the British Military Intelligence Section, known as MI9. We had expected that he would... Am I coming through?
Yeah.
He had expected to be with us, but unfortunately, he is unable. Colonel Langley, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Yes, sir. Would you say a word of hello to the 200 or so people in our Escape and Evasion Symposium, and including the airmen that you so graciously helped to escape?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, I am very proud and honored to be asked to speak to you at your symposium. I'm only very sorry that I could not be present, and that I knew I should have met some of the people I was honored in a very small way to help during the war. And I was very proud so to do. I hope you have a very good evening, and any questions you care to ask me, I'll be only too pleased to answer.
Well, I doubt very seriously if the electronic format will permit that at this time.
No,
but
that's all right.
We did want you to know that we were thinking about you, that we understand the reasons that you're not with us, and as an airman who was helped by a section of MI9, we want you to know of our appreciation for your efforts, and we also want you to know that your agents and the helpers that are here are carrying on very well for you. Thank you very much.
That is extremely kind of you, Mr. Patton. I am very, very touched, and I should only like to add two things. First of all, I was intensely proud to have had the honor to work with the Americans during the war, and we never had any friction whatsoever with between MI9 and the American counterpart, MISX. Now I'd like to say goodbye by simply saying to you, remember, if you have to do it again, he travels the fastest who travels alone.
That is good admonition, Colonel. Thank you very much. It has been our pleasure to talk with you. Goodbye, sir.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that's the first time that Ralph Patton has sounded like God. I don't know where he was, but it sounded as if it was coming from up there in the heavens. Now, sir.